Gary was a former student of mine, University of Arkansas, received a master's degree from me in 2005, and has been working in the city of New Orleans, mosquito and termite control board. And she's also doing a PhD at the same time on termites at University of Florida, so it's just a busy schedule for her. Unfortunately, she couldn't show up. Just giving an overview of what I want to talk about in here. First, talking about the role of field flies in pathogen transmission. We're talking about bacterial and protozoan pathogens. Review of some of the literature, first talking about some of the ones that kind of got people going about field flies, and especially E. coli, 157H7 a few years ago, and how showing how they could carry it. Also going a little bit about more recent ones. There have been several important papers that came out in 2007 in this area. A couple of case studies, one of which involves Carey's research looking at detecting Campylobacter and E. coli from field flies associated with poultry cattle operations in Arkansas. Another one, which was Sherry McElroy, which is now Sherry Brazil after she recently got married, and she was a student with Dayton Steelman and myself looking at the protozoan Coccozoma anastas from field flies. That one I'm going to talk more about, how we actually go about the technique, the developing, you know, primer specific for that assay. And then at the end, just talking about where do we go from here. You know, this is just the standard PCR technique, talking about how you can use real-time PCR to enhance these techniques. And there's something else that Sherry did, was the use of filter paper spot cards. So instead of your simple index spot cards, if you can use filter paper spot cards, you can use that to detect pathogens that the flies could be transmitting. So real quick, yes, no, are flies carrying diseases out there? All right, first, role of field flies in pathogen transmission. Usually, the field flies we're talking about, especially in Arkansas, we have the housefly Musca domestica, black garbage fly, and stable fly. So the house fly is the one that's most commonly seen as a nuisance fly. Places like Arkansas and a lot of the rest of the country have the urban encroachment upon traditionally agricultural areas, and the flies are often just seen as a nuisance problem. Nebraska had some really big cases about this a few years ago, where people would hang up a fly ribbon in their garage, and in a matter of 15 minutes, it'd be completely full of flies, and that was attributed to nearby feedlots. Black garbage fly can be a nuisance fly as well. This one has a different life cycle where the larvae can actually feed on other flies, such as house flies. That led to being promoted as a possible biocontrol agent in those areas. But as I'll talk about, this fly, not really a good idea because it can transmit pathogens more than a house fly, so not a real good biocontrol agent. Stable fly is also found, different than the other flies, where this is an obligate blood feeder, both sexes, but there has been some research showing that this fly could also be involved with pathogen transmission. So they have these large fly numbers that accumulate in these areas, disperse on the farm. So notice Arkansas, typical, you know, turkey operation here, we have thousands and thousands of birds. Another thing we have in Arkansas, pretty weak enforcement on carcasses. Quite often with these producers, when these birds die, they simply take them, throw them in a front-end loader or in a tractor in the bucket, get a week's worth of dead birds there, and then simply take them out in the pastures and throw them out there, which then results in terms of, there's a good byproduct to that, is that we have very high eagle populations there. And you can simply, from Fayetteville, go out 30 miles and park your car, and you can have 100 eagles on the trees and cliffs nearby, and they're simply feeding on these dead birds. But we have a huge number of eagles, but coyotes also do pretty well there as well off these dead birds. But again, it shows how, you know, there are a lot of possibilities for pathogen transmission. The other thing we have, especially in Arkansas, is we have a lot of the poultry operations, and right next to it, people are keeping cattle. So these are kind of smaller farms, but this is where we get the involvement of E. coli then getting moved in a lot with the poultry facilities, which typically you wouldn't see as much. And again, high density areas, these are located in very close proximity to towns quite often. These flies, especially the house fly and black garbage fly, feed and ovipositor organic substances. They can transmit the pathogens by contact, vomit droplets, or defecation. You can see here, they have an interesting SEM here of a tarsomere of a housefly, and they have a little arrow pointing here, so they are picking up actual little items on their tarsomere, so that's a mechanical transmission. As I said before, in Arkansas, we have both Campylobacter, E. coli, O157H7, and these flies have the capability to carry millions of these bacterial cells. Effect of these pathogens on humans, World Health Organization estimates about 2.2 million people a year die from foodborne illnesses. Campylobacter, species of Campylobacter, caused about 1.6 million illnesses a year in the U.S. back in 99, leading cause of gastroenteritis. E. coli O157H7, which is about the most important one, EHEC, caused about 31 deaths a year, roughly, in the 90s, going up to about 42 a year. And that's the one that gets a lot of press in the news, a lot of importance in California with the lettuce and spinach production. And there's a possibility then, nearby feedlots, could houseflies be actually be involved in transmitting pathogens. And as we quite often seen, when people go and look at the sources of these diseases, insects are quite often left out. I mean, they're just totally excluded from it, but could be involvement there. Just some of the literature looking at this. One of the important papers was this one published back in 2000 in Japan, where they're looking at the potential of houseflies and disseminating EHEC to food, and basically found that, in a lab environment, flies feeding on it, they could contain this E. coli for around 3 to 4 days, and they were very good at transmitting it, both by excretion and by regurgitation. And this just shows kind of more the traditional microbiology method of using it to identify if the flies are transmitting pathogen. Another one from 1999, again in Japan. This is one where they had a nursery school where the children were becoming ill. They went, sampled the facilities, found that there were houseflies inside the school. Actually found some differences where some of the kids in different age groups were more exposed classrooms than other ones. The ones in more closed classrooms, less of them were sick than the other ones. There was a cattle facility right adjacent to the school. Went and screened the houseflies using traditional microbiology methods and verified that these flies were carrying E. coli O157H7. Okay. Next, I want to talk about some of the recent literature. There have been a few papers that have come out this year. First one, and this is one if you went to the Section D Livestock Highlights, Tanya McKay talked about this one a little bit. This is one that involving research in Germany where they went out and you tell these people, I don't think they're really entomologists, because you go out and collect 56 flies and then use that for a paper. I mean, flies aren't too hard to get, especially field flies and other flies, californids and everything. So they went out and collected these flies from, I think it was like a dog pound, swine operation, livestock operation, from about 5 different. So ideas are really good, just numbers aren't there really. But they went out, identified the flies as species, and again, you see really low numbers for a lot of these flies. Of course, say you find a lot of house flies, nothing amazing there. Then went ahead and using molecular techniques then identified what pathogens these flies are carrying. And this was pretty important, where they didn't find E. coli O157H7, but they did find some of these other E. coli's and a lot of other important pathogenic bacteria, as well as several fungal species. So unfortunately, I mean, they didn't break it down exactly in the paper even, which flies are carrying which diseases or what habitat they were found. But it opened it up more about that, showing how many of these different pathogens flies could be carrying. Another one here, which is done out of Ludwig Zurich's lab at Kansas State University, and again, Tanya talked about this one a little bit, but this is really important, in which it showed that direct transmission under controlled environment, that yes, these flies, if they're infected with E. coli O157H7, exposed to calves for a set amount of time, then the animals were able to then pick up the E. coli. The only way the E. coli could get in there was by the flies. It was found in the cattle feces, and also when the animals were killed, it was found in the lumen contents of these animals. So to show the direct transmission potential of these flies. So this was a very important paper to demonstrate that this is possible. So when we had the traditional screening methods that a lot of the techniques in the past have used, first you have to isolate bacteria on selected media, which can be time consuming. That's about 24-hour incubation typically. The biochemical tests, antimicrobial susceptibility, and then getting the optimal growth conditions then takes several days to complete. Usually only screening for one pathogen at a time for each culture requires that you're working with viable pathogens, so that makes your biosecurity for your labs a lot more difficult depending on what you're working with. And you know, quite often if you're in a university, you know, as my lab is, an entomology department, you know, free access, anybody coming out, you know, using molecular techniques, fine, where you're working with DNA or cell cultures, they're all being killed, but you want to go to this and you get to like a biosafety 3 lab, it gets a lot more difficult, you may not have those facilities, and then just the time it takes, you know, you're talking about days to find out that something's there. That's where molecular could really help out with that. So when you get into the molecular techniques, and this will be focused and talk about, you get to where only a small amount of target DNA is required. So studies have shown you can take a single bacterium, single rod of bacteria, add it to, the studies have done where they add it to a gram of cattle feces, and you can then find that using PCR, recover it. Samples can quite often be highly degraded, and the DNA is still detectable. So pathogens do not have to be alive, but it's important, especially trying to get this work published, you got to go back and show that yes, you know, we had to do it where, yes, these flies are carrying viable pathogens to verify that, but they don't necessarily have to be alive in doing this. Time can be very rapid. The techniques we did was about, you know, 6 to 9 hours, but then if you were to go to real-time PCR and some other methods, you could cut that time down. In the right lab, you could do this in an hour. Very fast, it can be done. And then once you have the DNA extracted, and what we're doing is extracting whole DNA, the whole insect and the bacteria DNA at the same time, then you can use that for many different pathogens. It doesn't have to be all done at once. I'll talk a little bit more how you can store these samples. Very useful for years and years, and an easier way to share them among researchers. So two case studies. First one is talking about what Carrie did in her master's research. And this is looking at Campylobacter and E. coli from field flies associated with poultry. So what we did is that we went out to several poultry facilities in northwest Arkansas. And so this is showing a typical facility here. Aerial photographs showing the facility right here. And then a neighboring town approximately about a mile away. And what we did then is went out to these facilities once a week for 9 months over a 2-week period. And the way we collected the flies then was using these aerial sweep nets, which were autoclaved and exposed to UV light and a crosslinker to make sure there was no carryover DNA and nothing carried over each time we collected the flies. After we did the sweeping, both outside and inside the poultry facilities, then the flies are killed using potassium cyanide and then placed in individual Ziploc bags until they're transported back to the lab. Once they're back in the lab, the flies are frozen at minus 80 degrees Celsius and then later identified as species and sex. DNA is extracted from the flies basically using a pure gene DNA lysis method, pretty standard technique for doing that. And what we did from each sample then, we pulled out 16 males and 16 males of each one if we could, of house fly and black garbage flies, and then stored it at 20 degrees Celsius. And then this just shows a paper that published in 2004 when we first had the technique working, and then Carrie kind of expanded a lot more on that technique. The nice thing with this is that you can just go ahead and just find out all the primers that have been already, people worked on and found in the literature already, so you don't have to necessarily go out and find all these primers. So we just used standard Campylobacter primers, ones for E. coli serotype 0157, which amplifies a gene for antigen biosynthesis, and then for the other serotype, H7 primers, which amplify a portion of the FLIC gene, which codes for shingotoxin production. So it saves a lot of time and effort if you have these primers available. You just go and search the literature, find primers for the pathogens, and go ahead and simply start screening those. Quite often, you know, each of these papers also give, you know, what should be the optimal PCR conditions for doing the amplification. And this is showing typically what you can get when you do the PCR. All you need to do is take out, you know, ours, we did the extractions, resuspended in 50 microliters of TRIS EDTA and only using about half a microliter, 1 microliter for PCR, so you can get a lot of PCR reactions out of that. And when you run it on the gels, it's showing multiplex, where that involves adding more than one primer set at a time. So it speeds up your analysis, looking at more than one or two, one thing at a time, you can do multiple ones. So this is showing getting Campylobacter here, 3 positives at 857, and then down below at 625 base pair, we're getting for the E. coli H7 serotype here. And then always having your positive controls very useful to have for these as well to verify PCR was successful. Also, when you use these primers, a consideration in multiplexing is you want to have, you know, of course, your PCR product enough different in size so you can really distinguish it. We found with the multiplexing that typically we couldn't do more than about 2 primer sets at a time with this, and we figured that just because you have such a huge amount of insect DNA as background DNA, and that could possibly be inhibiting some of the PCR success for these bacterial pathogens. So once we've got it going, then we sequenced some of these samples to confirm that the PCR amplification was working properly. You just, you know, since you're getting PCR products right size, you can assume that it works successfully, you're getting what you want. But it's just so easy nowadays just to take that, purify it, sequence it, get your sequences back from both directions, and then do a blast search, because there's just so many millions of sequences available in GenBank now, and verify, yes, that's exactly what we're looking for. You don't have to do it every time, but just good to do it initially. We also then did cultures of both Campylobacter and E. coli 0157H7 to verify that the flies were carrying viable pathogens. Unfortunately, we have a very good poultry research department there, and we'll be able to use some of those labs over there, which had the right biosafety level to verify that they were carrying biosafety viable pathogens. And also, we did culture and performed PCR turkey dropping samples as well to test them for Campylobacter. Then what Carrie did is that she went to the next level, whereas my paper just saying yes, the technique works, and she did some statistical analysis on it. So this is just kind of showing kind of what we found, and you know, in terms of numbers, we have around here about 5,500 houseflies were screened for Campylobacter, and around 1,100 black garbage flies are screened for Campylobacter. We had the 2 facilities, 2-year periods, and again, both male and female. So here we have the percent that were positive, and in parentheses, the total number of flies that screened. So what we're seeing then is that houseflies, in about 17% of the male houseflies were positive for Campylobacter, 23% of females were. For black garbage flies, 18% of males, and a much higher number of females, 35%, were positive for Campylobacter. With the E. coli 0157H7, this just shows part of the data, but for 2002, roughly about 0.3 of the male houseflies, 1% of the female houseflies, and 0.6 and 0.9 for the black garbage flies. When we first did this, we were very surprised by the high numbers of flies that were carrying Campylobacter. It was kind of a surprise to us to see these numbers, and especially for the black garbage fly, where it has been promoted in the past as being a potential biocontrol agent, and showing how it can be really transmitting these pathogens, you know, really makes it, you know, you don't really want to involve that at all as a biocontrol agent when it's carrying pathogens like that. The statistical analysis on this was that, you know, was there a difference between the farms that was not significant for Campylobacter? There was a significant difference then between the black garbage fly and house fly. The black garbage fly had a higher prevalence of Campylobacter than the house flies. Was there a difference between males and females? There was a significant difference for both house flies and black garbage flies for females. And potentially then it could be due to overposition behavior. If the female is much more likely to be landing down on the substrate than the male flies, that could be possibly why they're picking up more of the pathogens in the males. For 0157H7, again, no difference between the farms, and again, we had a significant difference between black garbage flies and house flies. Okay. So again, we found that this method was very sensitive. Doing this technique of extracting whole insect DNA, screening for pathogens, the high concentrations of insect DNA did not inhibit the PCR, but it did cause some problems when you tried to multiplex more than two PCR primer sets at the same time. The way we were doing it, just kind of additional, where it took about 2 hours of DNA extraction, PCR about 2 hours, and then roughly about another hour for doing the agarose gel electrophoresis. The test can be completed in about a 6 hour period, and it kept the student undergrad really busy because they were extracting about 100 flies a day. So can be kind of labor intensive that, but much less than what it does for traditional methods for screening for it. One thing we did find in kind of an offshoot was that when we had finished this and we had these thousands and thousands of house flies, that we had about four freezers full of these flies and just kind of running out of space to keep them all. So something we thought about is that we have been using these Wattman FTA cards, which are quite often used to collect blood samples, especially for forensic use. And what it is, it just simply has a lysis buffer on it. You put the blood on it, or you can even smash an insect on it in the field. That then lyses the cells and preserves it, kills any bacteria on it, and it's a good way of preserving DNA. They found they could use these for about 14 years for preserving DNA. So what we had Carrie do was then we used this Harris Micro Punch, which is item here, which is used a lot with the Wattman cards, and it simply punches out a 2 millimeter disc that you punch it out of the, this showing the filter paper here, circle where we had put the DNA. And then you just simply take that disc, put it in your PCR tube, and use that for PCR. And from that one circle there, and then you get about, you know, several hundred punches out of there. So it's a great way, one, of storing your samples. Then we just simply put the DNA on the filter paper, just put it in envelopes, and store it in a normal card drawer. And so all of a sudden you go from four freezers down to, you know, space like this. Much more simpler to do. We ran it out, I think about almost a year, found it to be stable, still able to replicate being amplified DNA. Also really facilitates sharing samples among researchers, so you don't have to go in, pipe it out, a couple microliters out of your tube, put another one, and worry about the tubes opening while shipping. All you got to do here is simply punch out the punches, put them in PCR tubes, and mail it to a collaborator, and then they can then use the samples. So was kind of an interesting spin-off from that research. When we published that first paper at the same time, Alum and Zurich also did a paper where they looked at E. coli 0157H7 cattle feedlots using both traditional microbiological and PCR methods. And what they found was about 2.9% of the flies collected from feed bunks and 1.4% collected from a cattle feed storage shed were positive for 0157H7. So higher numbers than what we found, which is probably to expect because, you know, E. coli is a lot more associated with the cattle. But again, showing how, you know, flies have potential to carry pretty high rates of EHEC in that environment. Okay. So the next one here, in terms of case studies, is talking about what Sherry Brazil did as part of her master's research at the University of Arkansas. And this was molecular detection of the protozoan Coccosoma anastas from field flies. Poult enteritis mortality syndrome, or PEMS, is an acute infectious disease of turkey poults and has a rapid onset and a high rate of mortality. And here you can just see how these are birds showing the symptoms of it. Very, very sick birds, obviously. The specific causes of this are unknown, but generally thought to be caused by a group of pathogens, one of which is this protozoan Coccosoma anastas, and just simply a line drawing over here. But again, the birds have lots of feathers, dirty appearance, stunted growth, and dehydration. When this outbreak of PEMS occurs in the southeast, it costs the turkey industry millions of dollars of losses annually. And traditionally, identification of this protozoan is simply by visual identification of the protozoan from the poult intestine. So here's showing how cross-section of the villi here and showing where the protozoans are. So what we thought of doing is developing a molecular diagnostic technique for this protozoan. And the way we went about it was from the University of Missouri. We were able to obtain Coccosoma anastas infected intestinal tracts from turkeys. And again, just another picture here showing the sick birds in a brooder house, and again, the environment, quite often in Arkansas, we find a lot where these houses are completely exposed on the sides, which really facilitates fly movement in and out of them. We then took them, did a DNA extraction from them, and amplified using universal primer sets for it, and then went ahead and used it to develop primers specific for coccozoma. We then screened housefly and black garbage flies from those facilities over a several-year period. The PCR was successful, and Sherry published that a few years ago. And they're showing here again from these flies, 9% positive for Coccozoma nastus, black garbage flies as well was positive for both of them. So both house flies and black garbage flies. So it was a very successful technique for that. And I'll just speed this up a little bit here and get into the enhancement. So one of the ways to enhance this method over what we're doing is using real-time PCR. This shows an ABI step one real-time PCR. The price has really dropped in these. This is about $20,000 for it now, which is a fraction of the cost years ago. But using fluorescently labeled probes, such as here, you can screen for multiple pathogens at once. The time required can drop to as little as 45 minutes for it. So it's a much faster way. Plus, using real-time, you get an idea of how much of the pathogen DNA was present, so it gives you an idea of how much was there when you started the analysis. So a quantitative method of looking at it. The other one I want to talk about is using the traditional spot card method to screen for pathogens. So quite often, spot cards, which are 3x5 index cards, can be placed in various restaurants, feedlots, poultry facilities, and used as an idea to get an idea of fly density. So usually after a week period, if you have 100 regurgitation, defecation spots on the card, that's an indication that fly control should be implemented. However, you cannot determine what fly species there, number of spots deposited per fly, but what we thought about is, can you use this method to detect pathogens? So just a simple yes-no test, are pathogens present? So we took Wattman 11-centimeter filter paper cards, filter paper, stapled them on index cards, and placed them on the ground and on the sides of at the dairy farm and on turkey farm, placed them along the building, and after 1 week went back and removed them. And you can see here we had showing the number of spots, so they were getting a lot of regurgitation, defecation on these cards. Then simply use again our Harris micro punch that we were using before, and what we did was we punched out 10 spots from each one and used them for PCR using our E. coli, Campylobacter, and Coccozoma nastus primers that we've used before. And what we did find was that we were able to pick up E. coli H7, Campylobacter, and Coccozoma nastus from these pools. So it shows that this could possibly provide a very valuable technique for monitoring for pathogens carried by field flies with livestock operations around restaurants. You don't have to use the flies at all, but yet if you want to find out yes, no, it's occurring, I think that could be a very useful technique for that. And we've just submitted a paper demonstrating that technique. We'd like to thank the following people: Dayton Steelman, Sherry Brazil, Jackie McKern, Jennifer Luter, James Austin, Amber Tripodi, and Matt Tolliver, as well as the USDA PMAP grant, which funded a lot of this research. Thank you. I don't know. I mean, I think the filter paper really helped preserve it better, but we didn't look at traditional cards. Somebody could definitely try it. It might work. I don't know. We also tried a little bit to see if we could identify fly species. There was possibly anything from the gut being passed on defecation, but we were not able to identify fly species.
Yeah. On that, that data, PCR data you showed, that one slide, 02 to 04, where you developed primers from amplified regions in 16 inch farm, is that published?
The coccozoma ones?
Oh, this is for, yeah.
Yeah, yes, that it has been published.
Did you put a reference on it?
Yeah.
John, Yep. Question for you. I like the punch assay with the spot cards. I'm wondering if mostly the town flies are going to get those spots, but there may be some other flies doing that. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible to identify using molecular techniques the species of fly that left that spot as well as the pathogen.
Yeah, that's what I was just talking about. We tried it a little bit, not a lot, but it was not successful. Okay. I just think they're not passing enough. Yeah, the statistics, yeah, and that was one of the problems with statistics with that, is that we were finding some differences. I didn't talk about that, but yeah. So one of the problems is that we were collecting the flies, but they're trying to quantify fly numbers or the exact operations, that there were differences in the way the cattle were being maintained or with the birds. So that's something we could possibly look at again. No, I just think, I don't know. I mean, I think it's always fluctuating, I think, naturally, and we just happen to come in between two of those periods during that. Yes?
With regard to his question, in determining the species of fly in New Jersey, where did you get the primers you were using to determine the species?
What we were using was just standard cytochrome B primers for that.
For each fly species, or just for?
Yeah, there are published markers. We just used universal one for that and see if it worked or not, and it didn't work. We got nothing at all from that. But if it did work, then you simply just use an RFLP or sequence and just compare to GenBank and let you know. All right, thank you.